The History Channel Original Podcast.
History This Week, February 23rd, 2005. I'm Sally Helm. Bibendum is a funny-looking character. White, puffy, made of tires. We're using his given name, but you might know him better as the Michelin Man. And today, Bibendum, a person dressed as Bibendum, has been all over New York City. He goes to Central Park, takes in the trees. He visits Times Square. We don't know whether he made it to a Broadway show. And when he poses for pictures, he holds in his bulbous hands a giant fork and spoon. Because Bibendum's employer, Michelin, they don't just make tires. They also publish the most famous restaurant guide in the world. That night, at New York's Gotham Hall, Bibendum rubs elbows with some culinary big shots. Daniel Boulud, Eric Rappaire, Anthony Bourdain. This city is a top food destination. But until now, the Michelin Guide has not seen fit to bestow its famous stars upon the culinary elite of New York. They have been operating for over 100 years, but only in Europe. Now, that is about to change. In fact, it already has. CEO Edouard Michelin takes the podium and reveals that his company's famous inspectors have been hard at work for months, secretly making their way through about 1,200 New York restaurants. He says the New York City Michelin Guide will come out later that year, with reviews of 500 of those restaurants. If the New York version of the guide is anything like its European counterpart, a star or two or three could catapult any given restaurant onto the global stage. Among the chefs in attendance, the reaction is mixed. Some are excited, some are nervous, some are even angry. Eric Rappaire, chef at Le Bernardin, is cautiously optimistic.
I was interested and I thought, oh, this is pretty good. I like the idea of Michelin coming to New York because I thought it would bring something new.
But no matter how the chefs feel, Bibendum has officially arrived. Today, the Michelin Guide comes to the United States. Which restaurants win? Which lose? And how does the battle itself transform American food culture?
I'm Serena Williams, and I'm healthier on Row. I've lost 34 pounds in a year with GLP-1s, diet, and exercise. On Row, you can access GLP-1 options, including the first FDA-approved GLP-1 pill for weight loss. Go to row.co/journey to see if you qualify. 14 to 20% average weight loss in 1 year in non-diabetics with obesity or overweight with a weight-related medical condition versus 2.2% to 3.1% in placebo arm. Rx only. To stay informed about serious side effects, go to row.co/safety.
The first few weeks back at school set the tone for the entire year. But with new teachers, schedules, and expectations, it can feel like a lot. If you're looking to help your child start strong and stay confident, I've been using IXL to make that transition so much easier. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, it adapts to each child's level and pace, making it easy to spot and close learning gaps in just a few minutes a day before those gaps can snowball. Plus, it's trusted nationwide. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL, and it's used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. It's an easy, cost-effective way to get kids back into a learning routine and walking into class feeling ready and reassured. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. Listeners can get an exclusive 20% off an IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
One of the people in New York's Gotham Hall that February evening was a chef who had been a fixture of the city's culinary scene for a decade.
I am Eric Ruppert, chef of Le Bernardin in New York City.
Le Bernardin has long been considered one of the top restaurants in the world. Eric Ruppert has been its executive chef since 1994. He still goes in nearly every day.
I'm lunch and dinner Monday to Friday at the restaurant. I go home and I have this sense of like, wow, I have done something good today.
Ruppert grew up in France and in Andorra, a small country between France and Spain. When he was little, he'd hang out in the kitchen with his mom or his grandma.
I was allowed in the kitchen, but I couldn't cook or touch anything other than eating.
Family meals were a real to-do in their household. Appetizer, main course, dessert, tablecloths, flower arrangements. And they also made it a point to visit restaurants from the Michelin Guide.
So when I was going to a Michelin-rated restaurant with my family, to me it meant celebration. And it was a special moment.
The Michelin Guide, by the time Ruppert's family was following it, had already existed in Europe for decades. Kathleen Squires is a food and travel writer.
The history of Michelin in Europe is actually genius marketing. It started around 1900. Michelin is a tire company. And from what I understand, there are only a few thousand cars on the road in France. So how do you sell tires? Well, you get more people on the road. You get more people buying cars. How do you get more people on the road? Well, you offer them something, a destination. What are the French interested? What destinations are they interested in? Well, good food and restaurants. So that's how the Michelin Guide started. It was as a guide of where you can drive in your automobile and potentially wear out your tires so you could people can buy more tires.
In 1926, the Michelin Guide implemented its now famous star rating system. A restaurant can get either 1, 2, or 3. Kathleen Squires explains it's more than just good, better, best.
So one Michelin star is if you're driving along the road and you see a restaurant on the road and it has one star, you pull over and you will be happy eating there. Two Michelin stars, well, you're driving through Lyon, but there's this little town outside of Lyon that you maybe want to make a detour and go hit that spot, and that's worth making a detour, getting off your path for. Three Michelin stars, you plan your trip around that restaurant. You buy the ticket, you make your reservation, and your whole trip revolves around you're getting that reservation and that special experience.
Eric Ruppert's family uses the guide exactly as it was intended.
But we were looking in a region where we were going in vacation for the 3 stars. And if it was no 3 stars, we were looking for the 2 stars. And then we were trying to do as many as we could. For me as a kid, I was looking at the service and I was dreaming. I was like, this is amazing what they're doing. And then I was eating the food and I was like, oh, wow, this chef is so creative.
For the young Eric Ruppert, a life's work is beginning to come into view.
I was appreciating every detail of the experience without even thinking about ratings because I was just experiencing as a client.
But those chefs, the kind of chefs who would one day be Eric Ruppert's peers, they were thinking about the ratings, specifically about the Michelin stars.
I think it was extremely stressful. I think it was the gold standard. There was a lot of pressure put on European chefs to get those stars.
Ruppert goes to culinary school at 15 and takes his first job in a kitchen at 17.
My first job after culinary school was in La Tour d'Argent in Paris. Iconic restaurant. At the time, it was a 3-star Michelin celebrating their 400-year anniversary.
Yes, it had opened in 1582 And those three stars, they were coveted.
We were speaking Michelin, 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 Michelin all the time, constantly reminded of the standards of Michelin, what needed to be done to be in a Michelin and so on. So I was very familiar with it.
But in 1989, Repair moves to the U.S., where the restaurants don't have Michelin stars. At first, he's in D.C. Then he makes the move to New York City.
Because I was bored in Washington at night. So when I came to New York, I was amazed by the energy of the city, by the vibrancy of the city, by the quality of the restaurants, by the quality of the bars and hotels. And it was really something that was marvelous for me.
In 1991, he lands at the restaurant where he still works today.
And I came to Le Bernardin, and the rest is history.
Repair becomes the executive chef in 1994.
Eric really made the menu his own.
Kathleen Squires again.
Focusing on beautiful seafood, which not a lot of people were doing during that time. And he just really made the food shine on the plate.
Repair is thriving at Le Bernardin. And especially by the late 1990s and early 2000s, Kathleen Squire says the overall food scene in New York is thriving too, in a new way.
It was really burgeoning in the sense that dining was not just for special occasions anymore. Part of that, I think, had to do with the advent of Food Network and chefs becoming celebrities in a sense, and people really wanting to become part of a social scene that was something besides nightclubs, bars, theater.
Remember, this is before the internet exploded, certainly before social media. Peter Esmond was general manager at Per Se, a restaurant owned by chef Thomas Keller.
At that time, there is no marketing for a restaurant. Like, you don't market at all. Your best marketing is a great customer experience, because if that person has a great experience at your restaurant, they're going to go tell their friends, and then their friends are going to come, and then they'll eat, and then they'll tell their friends. And like, that is how you build a successful restaurant. But especially at that time, when like, you have no other way. And so these publications hold a lot of power at that time.
The publications Esmond is talking about are the places where the food critics publish their reviews. Newspapers, magazines. They're seen as the authorities on where to eat in the city.
New Yorkers relied on the New York Times. That was the standard.
If you had a good review in the New York Times, you were fine for a couple of years, full. If you were getting a bad review from the Times, probably you were closing your restaurant within 6 months.
You had other newspapers, the New York Post, the New York Daily News, New York Magazine was very influential in terms of dining. And then you had Zagat, which everybody looked at as kind of the popularity contest.
The Zagat Guide will definitely make you very busy or not very busy, depending if you were number one or number two or 10 or whatever in their classification.
The Zagat Guide relied on reviews from thousands of people. It ranked restaurants in cities around the world.
It was democratic in the sense that people, the diners, were doing the reviewing. It was Yelp before Yelp happened. I like to say that I started writing about food back when Yelp was a sound that only puppies made.
So you have the reviewers, and you have Zagat trying to represent the voice of the people. And then there's Michelin, still hanging out over in Europe. But starting in 2004, rumors are swirling in kitchens across New York that Bibendum's eye might be turning towards America.
It was a rumor in the industry that Michelin was coming. I was interested and I thought, oh, this is pretty good. I like the idea of Michelin coming to New York. And I remember discussing it with some journalists and they were like, they're not going to last.
Let's not forget that the French weren't the most popular people around that time in the U.S. because, well, they didn't support our invasion of Iraq, for example.
This is the era when some Americans were calling French fries freedom fries.
That was a little bit of the feeling, the general feeling about the French in the U.S. and New York. So did New Yorkers want the French coming here to judge our restaurants? I think no. You had some American chefs and restaurateurs who said, I don't need your validation, Europe. I mean, we're doing just fine here. I would rather have my 3 or 4 New York Times stars. I would rather have my very high Zagat rating than for some interloper to come in and say whether or not I'm up to the standards of someone, you know, far away.
Eric Repair, though, he is much more enthusiastic.
I thought it would bring something new to have those three systems. Opinion of a journalist, you had the Zagat, which was a survey, and inspectors.
Inspectors. That's what Michelin calls the people who come in and assess restaurants on their behalf. It's part of a system that has been refined for over 100 years.
What I like about the Michelin process, I like several things. I like that they are anonymous, and I like that many times here were people coming that weren't already in the scene.
Yet New York restaurants could spot the known critics. According to Peter Esmond, amongst restaurant staff, it was kind of a game.
We had pictures from other restaurants of what people thought the food reviewer looked like because they took a picture somewhere. Like, it was like a spy sort of piece that would be up, like, he looked like this, but then somebody mentioned that he came in or she came in with like glasses and a hat on. So here's what he looks like, might look like, with glasses and a hat, like, you know, 8x10 pictures on a bulletin board.
But this game of spycraft, it was for the people who attached names to their reviews. The Michelin inspectors were anonymous. And apparently, these anonymous inspectors were starting to eat their way through New York's restaurants. If you were an employee who wanted to try and spot one of these mysterious characters, there were, in theory, some clues you could look out for.
The Michelin would come as a solo diner. They would just come by themselves.
Once you start to notice someone coming a lot, you might want to flag the staff. And how thoughtfully they're eating. What are they ordering? Many times I'll go to a restaurant and I love a dish and I have to go back for that dish. But as a Michelin inspector, you're going to try to eat your way through the whole menu. So I think that if you notice that someone is working their way through a menu, then something's up there.
But even if you were pretty sure you'd identified a Michelin inspector, there were probably several more. In early 2005, Michelin confirms that there have been at least 5 inspectors working in New York.
They would send more than one inspector to a worthy restaurant, which I think is also important, so that you have multiple points of view.
And all of those people are really thinking about one thing.
It's all about the food on the plate, not necessarily the service, not necessarily the atmosphere.
There are 5 criteria: the quality of ingredients, the mastery of flavor and cooking techniques, the harmony of flavors, consistency between visits, and then, maybe the most abstract, the personality of the chef in the cuisine.
I think personality is a strange word that they use for that criteria. I think it's more point of view. You know, I think it's, are they telling a story?
Peter Esmond, who was at the time working at Thomas Keller's Per Se, says, yeah, he knew what that story was.
His food is very, very Thomas in the sense that it's playful, it's nostalgic. You know, he's got dishes like mac and cheese and pigs in a blanket and things that are very reminiscent of a boy who grew up in Florida in America.
Well, the menu is very personal.
Eric Repair of La Bernardin.
It's a reflection of my experiences and work with the team. So I have a very strong vision of what I want to deliver as an experience that includes great food and great wines and great service in a beautiful decor and so on.
But in 2005, he says he knows he can't get too in his head about the food just because the Michelin inspectors are coming to town.
If I can make an analogy, it makes total sense. It's like an actor on stage thinking about the Oscars all the time. He's going to forget to act, right? And he will never get the Oscar.
And then finally, Oscar Day arrives. In early November, the first New York City Michelin Guide will be released.
Looking for a simpler way to explore medical weight loss options? Orderly Meds connects you online with licensed healthcare providers so you can learn about GLP-1 treatment options from home. It's convenient, straightforward, and designed to fit your lifestyle. Get started today at orderlymeds.com/podcasts. That's orderlymeds.com/podcasts. Again, orderlymeds.com/podcasts. Compounded medications are not FDA approved. Results may vary. Consult a licensed healthcare provider to determine if treatment is appropriate for you. Restrictions apply.
November 1st, 2005. Michelin inspectors have been making their way through 1,200 New York restaurants for over a year. And all of these chefs, they want those stars.
I think it's pride. I think it's business. I think it's an honor. It signifies success.
Peter Esmond remembers the moment that Per Se got word, the result of the Michelin inspections.
There's a phone in the kitchen. Everybody knew who was calling, and so like the kitchen just sort of comes to a halt. He said like, yeah, we got it. And everybody screams, and I think we had champagne that night and, you know, the full nine yards.
Thomas Keller gets 3 Michelin stars.
And for him, it was particularly meaningful because he is the first American chef to get it.
Eric Repair is walking through Central Park, as he does every morning on his way to work at La Bernardin. He gets a call on his cell phone.
I didn't know if Michelin would come to the U.S. and give 3 stars right away like that, or if they will do what they do in France, you start with 1 and 2.
Eric Repair also gets 3 stars, the most you can be awarded.
Like, wow, what's going on here? What's happening? We are really shocked. I mean, the ones who knew Michelin are like, cannot believe it, because again, we never thought you could start at 3 stars.
Repair celebrates with his staff that night with champagne and caviar.
And then the next step was to go to the party.
The following night, November 2nd, Michelin throws a huge event at the Guggenheim Museum. The line to get in wraps around the block.
It was packed with chefs and people from the industry.
Bib Bendham is in attendance as well. Apparently he knocks into someone holding a champagne glass who spills it. And then the big moment.
Suddenly through the staircase, some waiters with white gloves and trays were carrying the Michelin guide.
The 2006 New York City Michelin Guide, presented on silver platters. Michelin ends up rating 507 New York restaurants, only 39 of which were given any stars. Only 4 restaurants, including Per Se and La Bernardin, are given 3 stars. And of course, not everyone is happy with the results. Some people have real critiques.
There was a lot of talk and pushback about how Michelin didn't understand New York. There was a lot of criticism about the lack of diversity on the list, that it was the restaurants tended to be mostly European-based.
Those 507 reviewed restaurants represented just about 2.2% of the restaurants in the city. And the ones that got stars did lean heavily towards European cuisine. There weren't any Chinese restaurants on the list, not any Indian restaurants, or Mexican, or Thai. And people had other criticisms, too.
I remember the New York Post, Steve Kozo, kind of nitpicking about the guide. And one thing was that the guide, instead of Subway, said Metro, and really mocking the guide because of those details. They don't even know to call it the Subway. They're calling it the Metro.
In that first guide, there are also some surprises, like Peter Luger, a famously no-frills steakhouse in Brooklyn, got a star. The New York Michelin Guide has endured, with a new version released every year since. It does now include a more diverse restaurant selection, and there are now guides for lots of other U.S. locations, too. Michelin stars still matter a lot. They still have the power to cause controversy.
There is a chef that sued Michelin for taking away a star. And in fact, that same chef I was reading last week has now officially banned Michelin inspectors from entering his restaurant.
Yes, French chef Marc Veyrat sued Michelin in 2019 after they downgraded his restaurant from 3 stars to 2 over the alleged use of some cheddar cheese in a souffle. And he has banned Michelin inspectors from his newest restaurant.
So I don't know how he's going to know, but he made a big fuss over that. Might be publicity stunt. And then there's a Korean chef who sued Michelin for being included in the guide.
That is right. Chef Oh Young-gwan sued Michelin for the thing that is supposed to be good.
He said that he wrote to them and said, do not include me in your guide. I think he was concerned about the pressure it would put on himself and his staff. I think he was concerned about becoming overrun after that, which is a consequence of some of these awards and guides. So, you have reactions of all sorts.
Yeah, in an online world, a restaurant really can be overrun after an honor like this. And, of course, the internet means that Michelin has a lot more reviews to compete with. Google, Yelp, random people on social media. Though Kathleen Squires says that kind of gives Michelin an opportunity.
There's so much noise out there. Just because some guy on TikTok likes a chicken salad sandwich and is raving about it doesn't really mean that it's the best chicken salad sandwich in the world. So it's good to have those standards. It's good to have someone who's eaten, maybe 150 chicken salad sandwiches before he determines which one is the best.
But Peter Esmond warns, Michelin also can't ignore the internet.
If the public is all saying that this restaurant is the best restaurant in Miami, then Michelin needs to be prepared to say, nope, it's not. It's terrible. And the public outcry if they do that versus... do they just kind of need to follow the trend now and say okay, everybody says this is the best, so we're going to say it's the best, and here you go. That's a very tough position to be in when you're kind of in a consumer business now. So I do think it's a very challenging place to be in.
But Kathleen Squires says Michelin has also changed American food culture in some key ways.
Look at what's happened since Michelin came to New York. Food and dining became more of a competition more than enjoyment in some ways. Iron Chef and Top Chef and people learning about chefs, learning about food.
So that makes food kind of a battle. But it also means people are just super interested in restaurants and what happens in the kitchen.
Then in 2022, here comes this show, The Bear, which is a sensation because I think people wanted to see the whole 360. How does this happen? How is it put together? It's about the chef, but it's about everyone behind the scenes. It's about the food. It's about the guy in the back who's fixing the electricity. It's about the health inspections. It's about the training. It's about all the dynamics that go into it. So I think that you can definitely see from where Michelin came to US, a straight line from that to today and a show like The Bear.
As for Eric Repaire, he is still the chef at Le Bernardin, and he still has those 3 Michelin stars. He says he's not focused on maintaining them, he's focused on the food. But for him, the power of Michelin is still as real as it was back when he was driving around the French countryside with his family.
Some people like it, some people dislike it. Sometimes it's controversial, sometimes it's not controversial. When we're looking at standards, Michelin is very much right on. When you travel and you go to a 3-star, it's very rare that that 3-star disappoints you.
1 star to stop along the road, 2 stars to take a detour, 3 stars to plan a trip around that restaurant, a place like Le Bernardin. Thanks for listening to History This Week, a Back Pocket Studios production in partnership with the History Channel. To stay updated on all things History This Week, sign up at historythisweekpodcast.com. And if you have any thoughts or questions, send us an email at historythisweek@history.com. Special thanks to our guests, Peter Esmond, the former general manager of Per Se and current sales leader at DoorDash, Eric Repaire, chef of Le Bernardin in New York City, and Kathleen Squires, a food and travel writer whose work appears in The Wall Street Journal, Condé Nast Traveler, and more. This episode was produced by David Weisbord, produced and sound designed by Ben Dickstein, and also produced by me, Sally Helm. For Back Pocket Studios, our executive producers are Ben Dickstein and David Weisbord. From the History Channel, our executive producers are Eli Lehrer and Liv Fidler. Don't forget to follow, rate, and review History This Week wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll see you next week.